You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the program, we're going to talk about venturing into New York's Central Park after dark to see what the park's animals do when the sun goes down. Our guide is journalist Marie Nguyen, the author of Red Tails in Love, Pale Male's Story, joins us to talk about her nighttime forays into Central Park. It's the subject of her latest book, Central Park in the Dark, More Mysteries of Urban Wildlife. Listeners, I invite you to join the conversation with your questions and comments. Do you have some nighttime stories of urban wildlife? Do you find yourself enchanted by the sounds of nature after the sun sets? Have you set out to explore your backyard or a nearby park in the dark? We look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Marie Nguyen has spent most of her life in New York City. She lives near Central Park. In addition to her books, Red Tails in Love and Central Park in the Dark, she's the author of The Plug-In Drug, Televisions, Computers, and Family Life, and Children Without Childhood. She's also written frequently for The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, and other publications. Central Park in the Dark, More Mysteries of Urban Wildlife, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And you'll find our guest online at her website, www.marienguyen.com. And that's W-I-N-N, marienguyen.com. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Marie, it's good to talk with you. How are you?
Celeste, I'm just fine. It's an absolutely beautiful day in New York.
Oh, good.
After a long spell of rain and winds and so on.
Yeah, well, we came through a wet, hellacious weekend, and then it was beautiful, and now we're on the hot and sticky side today.
Oh, it's a little hot here, I must say.
Yeah. Well, here, the cicadas are beginning to thrum. And there are some tiny frogs that are singing at night in our backyard. They come out and sing at night when we've had a good rain. And not long after dusk, we can see bats above. So here in mid-July, what's thrumming and singing in Central Park at night?
Well, the first cicada was heard about a week ago by one person. I'm definitely not hearing them. But the cicadas, as a matter of fact, are daytime singers, as far as I know. Maybe your Illinois cicadas are later in their song. What I write about in the book is their amazing nighttime transformations, because the insect goes through a metamorphosis, and that happens in the dark. So very few people have seen it if they haven't happened to venture into a place with a flashlight.
Hmm. So maybe I'm not hearing a cicada. Maybe I'm hearing something else.
Well, the cicada sounds very unmusical. It sounds like a mechanical kind of grating, drilling noise. Is that what you're hearing?
Well, maybe I'm hearing a katydid.
Ah, now there is a beautiful sound.
Yeah.
The crickets and the katydids are absolutely lovely sounds. I kind of like the cicadas, too, but it definitely sounds mechanical. It sounds like it's being produced by a machine.
And they're really loud, and they are daytime critters.
The cicadas are really loud, and one way to identify it, I'd say, is that it's not on one level. It begins sort of low, and then it gets louder, 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 and then it's...
That's right.
So, whereas the katydids of various kinds, including the one that goes katydid, katydidn't, they don't have that crescendo, decrescendo kind of effect. And crickets, nor do they. They just do their little creaky, lovely little sounds.
Chirp, yeah.
And they're beginning in Central Park, I heard. I heard one persistent set of crickets. So some, my trouble is that I really don't know what they are, and they're very hard to find. I can tell you there are about four different species, and a couple I have identified, and that is in the book. But the one time I went out with a cricket expert, he turned out to more or less be a rock expert. He just wanted to go out and have fun in the park, and we all did have a lot of fun, but I didn't learn a lot.
Well, what happens to the cicadas at night? What is this metamorphosis that they undergo?
Well, you know, like with butterflies, they don't start out that beautiful winged insect with those green transparent wings. And I don't know if you or any of your listeners have actually seen them, because, again, they're mostly insects that are heard.
Mm-hmm.
But they begin as an egg, like a butterfly does. Of course, you could go into the what comes first, the chicken or the egg. But let's start with the egg. The egg, out of the egg comes a larva. The larva is often called a nymph. And then out of that nymph emerges that beautiful insect. And what we've watched is that very dramatic metamorphosis of the ugly brown nymph sort of making its way along the forest floor or the lawn or wherever it comes out of, finding a tree. It chooses very carefully, and I'm not sure what governs the choice, climbing up, and then over a period of a couple of hours, although I can tell you if you've watched it, it goes like minutes. It's so compelling. Out comes this insect. First, you see a little tiny crack in that brown, and you think, was that little line there before? And then gradually it widens. Then you see something, sort of little green thing, start pushing its way out. This little green thing has little tiny stubby kind of wing buds. And meantime, the creature is kind of making its way out further and further. Then it makes its way kind of oozing onto some kind of little stick or branch. And then comes the moment that anybody who's seen this won't forget, where suddenly those little wing buds expand in a matter of maybe less than a second. Suddenly out they go and become wings, transparent, and then you can see the fluid begin to fill those wings and kind of pump through. It doesn't sound real, does it, when I describe
it?
But it is, and the state of people who are watching this, it's as if you've watched the most unbelievable magic show. You jaws are dropped, and suddenly you look at your watch and you realize you've been watching this for an hour and a half. Quite an experience. And actually, if you hear cicadas in your neighborhood, you can do this too. Just go out with a flashlight after dark. It happens in many suburban gardens, and you just have to find where those nymphs are coming out of the ground. And not easy, but very doable if you know what you're looking for. You're looking for a little brown, hard brown creature that just crawls along, looks like a kind of almost like a cockroach, you might say. But it is going somewhere in a very determined way. That's one of the ways to know that a show is about to begin.
Yeah. Now, how do the cicada killers, these are a wasp.
Now, Celeste, let me add one thing.
Yes.
Because I really would like your listeners to find this. One way of finding where you might see this show is to look on tree trunks for the empty nymph cases. Now they're kind of a brownish, almost transparent, thin kind of leftover little home of the larvae, and they remain attached on the trunk, and there usually are quite a few of them on a tree where they emerge. So keep your eye out for that.
Okay. So if we see those, then that night we should...
Yes, that night I would say look around near that tree and look for movement, and odds are if you see two or three of them on a tree, you will have the luck of having a living one make its way up and emerge before your very eyes. Mm. But I see you're going on to a very unpleasant subject.
Yeah. I'm wondering, though, how the cicada killers, how these wasps find cicadas.
That process actually happens in the begins in the day. And my guess is that they are listening.
Hmm.
They may hear their sound and have some way of kind of echolocating them. And the remarkable, they're quite a large wasp, and probably when you look at a picture of it, if you Google cicada killer wasp and look at the picture, you may recognize this wasp. It's a very big one. But
and we're glad it's not looking for us.
And we're very glad it's not looking for us. But though it is big, it's not as big as the cicada. That's the amazing thing about it, because it will find it in whatever marvelous way it has, and this has been going on for eons, so they do not fail to find it. Then they will inject it with a kind of paralyzing fluid with their stinger. But then comes the difficult part, where they have to drag this huge thing, and they've caught it on a tree, high in a tree. They've got to get it back to their nest, because they're going to feed their wasp young, who are now little larvae in a tunnel underground, on this non-dead but paralyzed cicada. Mm. And so that's a kind of journey that's rather amazing. They can't fly with it. They're not big enough. This thing would just drag them down. So what they have to do is kind of kite down. They make their way down a little ways of that tree, and then they'll sort of sail down with it, let gravity do the work, and then they'll drag. And they'll drag it and drag it. And if you know where their nests are, and that's not impossible either. We've done it, because they nest in kind of sandy, rocky areas,
mm-hmm.
and you can find telltale little signs that there's a cicada killer nest somewhere, because they leave little mounds of slightly wet sand where they have excavated for their tunnel. So one looks for those little mounds and then waits and waits, and all of a sudden you see this amazing thing of them dragging this thing down into that little inconspicuous hole.
Yeah. What led you to that first visit to Central Park in the dark?
Well, I would say that I had been in Central Park in the almost dark for a long, long time. But it was owls, really, that led me and my fellow night people, you might call us, to really begin exploring the nighttime park. We, in Central Park, owls are a big part of the bird watching winter scene. In the spring and in the fall, you have the migrations and hundreds of different species of songbirds on their way to somewhere, either to nest or back south for the winter. There isn't a lot going on in the winter. There aren't a large number of resident birds in Central Park. I forget the number right now, but something like 40 or 45, whereas during the migration you might have almost 200 species. So the excitement of winter is often discovering a wintering owl, not not easy to do because they are masters of disguise and they will be pretending their bark on a tree, but there are enough bird watchers that some sharp-eyed person will either find you with their eyes or use the screams of other birds who are programmed to protest the presence of a roosting owl, behavior that's called mobbing. And so that's a very useful way to discover an owl. But once an owl is found, they often remain in that nice roost for quite a little while, long-eared owls especially. And then begins a kind of, I think of it as an almost religious ritual called the fly-out, where people like me and other wildlife enthusiasts will gather a little before sunset, let's say, at that place where the owl has been seen roosting and, of course, sleeping because they're nocturnal, so what they're doing there in the day is sleeping generally. And then watching them wake up and begin to stretch and begin to preen and get ready for the owl day, which is night. So that fly-out ceremony is just a lot of fun, and it's almost a social event because you get to see the same people every night and so on. But that owl then finally takes off, and we will write down what time we happen to see the bird take off. And that goes on many, many days. And in fact, we looked at these flyouts for many years. And then one day, curiosity kind of overcame us of, well, we've been watching these flyouts, but where do they go? And
what do they do?
What are they doing? And so this kind of was the beginning where we overcame that residual and really, in my opinion, unnecessary fear of that is quite prevalent even today in New York. People think you're kind of suicidal to go into the park at night. But here I am to tell you that is not so. That kind of began it. We had our ways. We'd notice which direction they went, and we would go in that direction. Then there were little signs again. Even in the dark parts of the park, you'd hear somewhere nearby some birds beginning to sing, and birds you don't expect to hear at night, and we'd think, oh, some sparrows in a bush were awakened by the presence of an owl, and we'd head that way, and sure enough, we began to get kind of good at following them, finding them. And of course, there was always follow the rat. We kind of knew where we might be likely to find rodents, near bird feeders, for example, where seeds were scattered and so on. And the owls were hunting those rodents. Long-eared owls wouldn't necessarily be able to get a full-size rat, but they were quite delighted with baby rats and mice. And so that would have been our beginning.
Yeah.
But there was yet another area. Now we go out of the warm-blooded and into the cold-blooded area, another subject that brought us into the darkness, and this was insects, and especially moths, that we've been interested in following for a long, long time. And our first moth observing was done in fairly public places, but eventually we did venture more into the depths of the park. And you know, familiarity, as I say, doesn't breed contempt, it breeds content. When you know a place pretty well, if you've returned to it 3, 4, 5 times, you just don't feel uneasy there. It's a place like any other.
But, you know, that takes a little while to overcome that fear. As you note, it's an evolutionary relic. It's with us.
Yes, it's true. And I feel that those relics do have a purpose.
Yeah.
And so I don't mean to suggest to people to just go into some dark, deserted place by yourself and feel perfectly safe. I think, in fact, in a city like New York and probably many of your big cities in Illinois, everybody's a little cautious at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly am in New York. One keeps one's wits about one, is the way I would put it. And yet, one also judges by statistics. The crime statistics in Central Park are very, very low, and most of the crime there occurs in the daytime. Somebody goes up to somebody, you know, some bad guys go up to a lady and grab her purse. There are a few much worse crimes that happen.
Yeah.
But what happens in New York and probably in other big cities, those are hugely publicized. You know, there was that terrible jogger incident, as they call
yeah.
it, where a woman was assaulted by a gang of kids. It was a murky incident anyhow. Some of those kids really turned out not to be guilty. It wasn't what it appeared in the first place. But anyhow, that was a very fearsome incident, and people just reinforced it. It reinforced those fears. But bad things happen everywhere in the day, in the night. They don't happen terribly often, but they don't make headlines if they happen at noon, as they do if they happen in Central Park at night. So, I don't know. Does this make sense to you, Celeste?
Yes, it does. And I want to just there. You've only had a couple of moments of it being, you know. You know, taken aback. And,
yes, uneasy, let's
yeah,
say.
Yeah, uneasy. And, you know, here we might cue the theme from Jaws, and, you know, you're feeling a pretty comfortable, and you're walking by yourself, and then three big, tough-looking guys materialize out of the darkness.
I do remember that one. That's what I call, in the book, I write about two of them, and in truth, there weren't many more. I call those my uh-oh moment.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, where suddenly suddenly you feel this is it.
You know. Well, that was kind of a whew
yeah.
moment, too.
Though neither of my uh-oh moments I write about, nor the few others that I don't because they were even less consequential, were actually dangerous, and both mm-hmm. involved cops in one way or another. One were real cops who were undercover and pretending to be ordinary folks, and the other were these three guys who were pretending to be undercover. So, and if I were to tell you my human preference, I thought that the three guys pretending who actually were former bad guys in one way or another, I liked them better.
Bad guys turned into guardian angels.
Yes, exactly. They were quite lovable, and both the real cops who kind of scared me a little bit because they were so stern. What are you doing here in the dark? And the other guys ended our little encounter with now you go straight home and don't go in the park by yourself.
Yes, sir.
Happy to give me that little lecture.
Yeah. Journalist Marie Nguyen is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about her book, Central Park in the Dark, More Mysteries of Urban Wildlife. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Hoopston on line one. Hi. Do we have a caller there on line one? Maybe we'll check on that, and if the caller is still there, we'll get to them. If not, maybe they'll call back. Okay. Marie Nguyen, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Central Park in the Dark is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and you'll find our guest online at her website, www.marienguyen.com, and that's WINN.com. Well, I visited your website today, and I found photos posted yesterday of the moth tree,
which
is an English oak. And readers of Central Park in the Dark will find the moths and the tree early in the going in the first chapter and then again in later chapters. So tell us about this tree. What kinds of moths do you find on this tree and why are they drawn to that tree?
Well, the moth tree is it's actually a marvelous thing because it is oozing some kind of substance that attracts insects and especially certain kinds of moths. Not all moths are attracted to smells or substances. Some are very attracted by lights, as people know. There's a family of moths called underwing moths, which are called that because their hind wings, the underwings, are often beautifully colored, yellow and orange and black, just the very thing people do not think of when they think of moths. In fact, most people think moths are little brown creatures that eat sweaters. This is a major misconception. First of all, moths don't eat sweaters, only their caterpillars do. But it's only one species of moths that that are called the, what are they called? The clothing moth, or gotten its name right now. They're the sweater eaters, but that's one species out of 50,000. And those underwing moths that are attracted to our tree are just night and day, let me put it that way, as compared to the clothing moth. They're large. When they open up those forewings and reveal the underwings, they are absolutely ravishingly beautiful. And what has happened somehow, and I think I've come upon an explanation of it, is that we have quite a collection of different species of these underwings. We've had, I think, it may be 28 species. You know, you have to forgive me, but this book came out, and I've been writing it for a long, long time. And some of the actual statistics of, let's say, how many underwing moths, I've forgotten. I'd have to look it up in the index right now.
That's okay.
But anyhow, it's a big number, big enough so that people in much more isolated places, places where you would expect a much greater variety of moths, are absolutely jealous. They say, you've had 28 underwings, or the Latin name for that family is catocala, which means beautiful underneath, the two parts of that word. Catocalas are just beloved everywhere. They're such splendid, spectacular creatures. But I have had quite a bit of correspondence with a number of moth people who envy us right in the middle of New York City, our collection. Now, the next question is why? Why is this tree oozing this sap? And actually, I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
Because it's kind of a little mystery that I've solved in the book. I took us a long time to figure it out. And I guess somebody will have to read the book. You can go to the library if you don't want to buy it. And there it will be. It'll be in the last chapter, the one that's called Unhappy and Happy Endings. But I will tell you one thing that is not in the book, and that is that the unhappy ending was that we thought it was the end of our happy days at the moth tree. That was the unhappy ending, because it stopped oozing that wonderful stuff the last year that I was able to spend all the time there just before I wrote the book. Actually, it was last year. Since that was the very last chapter I wrote. This book was long in coming.
Yeah.
But the happy news is that our conclusion of what happened to that tree, which is sort of paradoxical, we thought it had now recovered from that illness that it caused it, an illness that has a wonderful name, and that's what I'm not telling. In fact, it's sick again, and that's why I'm posting pictures now again. And I haven't posted today because I left my camera at home, but I would have, and especially, Celeste, if I'd known you were going to be looking at the site. We had some beautiful ones last night.
Yeah, there's a large yellow underwing, and I've got it up now, and a once-married underwing.
The once-married is great. All the names of this family are very funny. I don't know if you remember some of them, but there's the girlfriend underwing, the bride, the sweetheart, and then those are the ones with the beautiful colors underneath. Then there are some that have also beautiful underwings, but they are black, shiny black. And those all have names like the sad, the mournful, the widow, and so on. Some entomologists long ago who are naming these moths must have had a heyday.
Romantics.
Romantic, yes.
Yeah. Well, how do you set up to observe moths and get these beautiful photographs?
Well, we have observed moths in a number of ways, and the hard way that we've done many, many times is to lug all this equipment into the park. You need a special moth-attracting light that's called a black light. You can get all this stuff. You can buy it online from places like BioQuip, equipment, biological supply places. And then you need a little generator that you can plug your bulb in and so on. And we did this for many years, and we set up a sheet, and then we hung the little black light on it, and we had beautiful moths, until somebody discovered the moth tree. And now the moth tree serves in place of lugging in the equipment. There it is, oozing its wonderful stuff, and we don't have to do anything but just come and admire.
Yeah.
And the photographs, I just use the simplest little digital camera. Mine is 4 pixels. I think nowadays that is considered chump change, right? Almost nothing, but it's perfectly fine for these purposes. It has a little setting that you can take stuff very close up, a macro setting. It requires absolutely no skill at all, in fact. You just push a little button and it zooms in and it focuses. And a couple of those pictures that are on the site that you saw that were in yesterday's posting that are on today were at quite a distance. I had to zoom. I think it'll do 11 times magnification, which is quite a bit. And I just push the button, and I push it a lot, so maybe one out of five will turn up. But you see immediately what you're doing wrong with the digital. So
yeah.
But that did transform our mothing, because before we had cameras and we wanted to identify, and that takes quite a little while. We didn't want to kill them. A lot of more scientifically minded people interested in this kind of thing have a killing jar, and they catch the insect and just pop it in, and that's it. But somehow we just couldn't do it. I'm not really judging the scientists. I know there are zillions of these insects, and it's insignificant to take one as a specimen. But this wasn't our style. So what we did then was we would capture it in a jar or something like that, or clap a plastic cup over it, and then be able to observe it for a longer time. And once in a while, for something really interesting, we would take it to the nearest refrigerator. One of our group has an apartment quite near to the moth tree. And if you put an insect into a colder place like a fridge, it will quiet down with no harm done. It's cold-blooded, so it goes into a kind of hibernation kind of thing. And then you can take the paper, the plastic cup off of it and really observe. Mm-hmm. And you can see when it starts shivering and getting heating up again. And then you put it back in the container and probably take it back into the park.
Yeah. You've used the word we, the pronoun we, and I want you to talk with us. Tell us about Nick and Jim and the people who are the Mothers. That's M-O-T-H-E-R-S, but it rhymes with authors.
Well, that's the thing. In a conversation like we're having, there's no problem with the word Mothers.
Right.
but in writing in a book, if I write Mothers, the reader sees that word as Mothers.
Yeah.
It's just your normal reaction to M-O-T-H-E-R-S in writing. So I had to always put in parentheses something like rhymes with authors or non-maternal Mothers or something like this.
Yeah.
And I find even myself after all these years, if I am looking over a page, if I see the word M-O-T-H-E-R-S written there, I will immediately think mm-hmm. Mothers. I don't automatically think Mothers.
Yeah.
So, but anyhow, the Mothers, who are they? This is kind of the wonderful thing about these kinds of communities. I wrote about similar communities in Red Tails in Love, the book, kind of the opposite or the reverse image book of this, a very daytime book, but also about Central Park. I'm in an office near Union Square, and somebody's making a lot of noise. Are you okay?
We're okay.
Oh, fine.
I'm sorry for your discomfort, but York City is a bustling place, so it's to be expected.
It looks like somebody is drilling in an office right next to mine. But
yeah, it sounds like a jackhammer, but it's it's faint on our end, but we can hear it.
Okay. Well, that's what it is.
Yeah.
In any case, these little groups of people have kind of gravitated to some subject of interest. Bird watchers are really in the same category, but that's a much more widespread occupation. They're lots and lots of bird watchers, while there aren't that many moth watchers. But when you get together with these people, you are you're a group in quite a different way than your normal get-togethers in life, where you're thrown together with people, you know their names, you know their occupations generally, you know quite a bit, or you make it a point to know. You kind of know whether they're rich or poor and whether they went to college or whether they didn't, that kind of thing that sort of defines groups in our society. A hierarchical kind of thing where, I don't know if I'm making sense to you, but that's sort of the way I see it.
Yeah, you're all from all different kinds of walks of life, but you share a passion. And it's the bond is quite interesting that you make.
You share a passion,
yeah.
And you also do not have the interests in the other parts. So most of us have never been to each other's houses, let's say.
Yeah.
Well, we may spend more time with each other than with our husbands or kids.
One of the things that you write about, there's a point in the story where you and Nick go to visit some folks in the park who are, their passion is astronomy and stars.
Right, the star guys.
Yeah, the star guys. And one of the star guys, Peter, had met Nick a couple of years earlier.
Yes.
And you talk about how magical that moment was for you and for Peter that he sees Nick again 2 years later, because it was on their first meeting that Peter fell in love or became so enamored of looking at the stars.
Yes. Nick is an extraordinary person, and I would say has inspired many people. He certainly has inspired me. He's an extraordinary person and also an odd person. He isn't somebody with huge social graces, let's say. He's not a sort of gracious, charming person. He's somebody who is so deeply interested in the things that he's interested in and has made a point of studying and learning so much that you just want to, you want to be with him and you want to be like him. And you, I don't have a sort of personal relationship with Nick the way I have with people who I consider my friends, you know, the few friends who I still have who I went to college with and you share a past with. You are like, the way I see it, sort of like pilgrims all heading for that certain goal. And in this case, it's to learn. And I happen to think that that is one of the basic human instincts, like the one where you want food or sex or that kind of thing. Mm. I think the instinct to learn is also is a neglected one, and that it's one that is a very powerful one, and everybody has it. I don't feel just a certain number of, you know, people like me who go and look in the park. I think everybody wants to learn. They just haven't. They haven't met Nick.
Well, the way you close out this chapter is you say, "Are stars aware that they shine?"
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that Nick is not, and he's now read this book, and he sort of fumbled and fumbled, and I dedicated this book to Lee, Noreen, Jimmy, and to Nick, my fellow adventurers, and to the ghost of Charles, who was part of our group.
Charles Kennedy, yeah.
He died, Charles Kennedy. Yeah. But Nick, you know, he said something, thank you for dedicating a little gruffly, and then he said, well, it was embarrassing, Marie. And I said, I really, my heart stopped, and I thought, oh, dear, did I tell too much about his bad moods on occasion? Or, you know, I said, oh, what was embarrassing? He said, well, you just made so much of me. that's not true. And so then I cheered up immediately because that's Nick, you know. He is not aware that he, or some part of him must be. He's a very, very smart, sharp, interesting guy, but that part of that sort of ego part is missing there.
Are there many New Yorkers who share this enthusiasm for the park at night?
I think the numbers are growing a little bit. Definitely the fear of night is diminished. Around the Moth Tree, we see many more people. And, you know, in a way, how can I put this in a kindly way? I mean, there are characters in New York and in Central Park, sort of weirdo people that photographers like to take pictures of. This Sister Marlene, who sometimes wears sort of bizarre false teeth or something like this. And so in a way, we mothers are kind of a known characters too, people on their way to the restaurant at the boathouse have been seeing us with our flashlights at this tree for years and years. And I can sometimes hear as people go by, I hear the word moth as in the conversation. So somebody said, what are those people doing? And somebody else who had already stopped there had explained that we're looking at moths. But I think more people are now aware that there are some interesting things going on. And around the cicada emergence time, we sometimes have quite a little crowd there watching this marvelous emergence. Mm.
We have to wrap up here. The time, I don't know where it's gone.
I don't believe it. Is that right?
Yes.
I talk too much.
No. If we were to have a couple of days in this city, those of us living here in the Midwest, what's the best way to see the park?
Oh, dear. Well, I would say, first of all, I would say you can check on what's going on my website in the winter, and there are a few other websites. I actually don't do a lot of posting about the owls because they're very vulnerable.
Yeah.
They sit in the same place day after day, and some of them you can actually reach out and grab if you wanted. So one is a little more circumspect. But generally, things going on, I will mention, and people can write to me. I have met lots of people who write in and say, how do I find the owl bench, or how do I find the moth tree? And that information is not secret. And I guess the other way would really be just, summer is really for insect life, if people aren't turned off insects. August, late July, August are wonderful times, and you can just look for people with flashlights.
And in the meantime, we can sit in an armchair and read Central Park in the dark, and we can read about slugs, and we can read about the owls and all the other stories that you tell in this book. It's a very fine time to be had in an armchair, Marie.
Thank you.
I want to thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
I've really enjoyed it, and I can't believe that all those minutes have gone by.
Whew, they flew by. Marie Wynn has been my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author most recently of Central Park in the Dark, More Mysteries of Urban Wildlife, the book published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And look for our guest online at our website, www.mariewynn.com. That's W-I-N-N.